Ukraine deserves peace through strength. Those were the words this evening of Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, deliberately echoing the language of Donald Trump after today's emergency meeting in Paris, where European leaders discussed their response to the Americans starting talks on Ukraine with Russia in Riyadh in the next few hours. She posted that on X, together with a photo of the leaders who were in the Elysee Palace. Among those at the table, Sir Keir Starmer, who certainly didn't downplay the stakes when he spoke after the talks had ended.
This is a once-in-a-generation moment for the collective security of our continent. Only a lasting peace in Ukraine that safeguards its sovereignty will deter Putin from further aggression in the future.
The Prime Minister went on to say that the Trump administration's message that Europe needs to do more for European security shouldn't have come as a surprise. And he repeated his offer of potentially placing British boots on the ground in Ukraine under certain conditions.
I'm prepared to consider committing British forces on the ground alongside others if there is a lasting peace agreement. But there must be a US backstop. Because a US security guarantee is the only way to effectively deter Russia from attacking Ukraine again.
While Britain seems set on playing the role of a bridge to the United States, other European leaders aren't exactly rushing to cross it. And no noses have been put further out of joint by recent American words and unilateral actions than German ones. And the first leader to leave the Paris meeting was the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Ahead of a general election at the weekend, he is widely expected to lose. He made no attempt to hide his irritation with the US-Russia talks.
It is completely premature and completely the wrong time to have this discussion now. I'm actually a little irritated by these debates. I want to say that quite openly. Discussions are taking place over the heads of Ukraine about various possible results of peace talks that haven't taken place and which Ukraine did not agree to and has not been at the table. I'll say it quite openly and honestly. That is highly inappropriate.
Well, let's speak to our Europe editor, Katia Adler, who is in Paris. Hi, Katia. Let's start with that suggestion again from the Prime Minister of European troops on the ground in Ukraine. How did it go down, as far as we know, with other European leaders?
So there are definite mixed opinions. I think when it comes to Olaf Scholz, it's... what you can hear is I'm on the Champs-Élysées in Paris, which you can hear all around me, even though the leaders' meeting has broken up. But yeah, the idea of boots on the ground, as it's often referred to, made a lot of noise at that meeting, and leaders definitely didn't speak with one voice. It's understood that the UK and France led the way there, but Spain and Poland were more reticent. We've heard just now from Germany. I would urge caution with Olaf Scholz's remarks, though. As you say, he is approaching a general election in Germany. He's also speaking to the electorate at home, whereas the CDU, which is the party, the Christian Democrat Party, which is expected to take the largest number of seats, today suggested that it would be open to sending troops to oversee an eventual ceasefire in Ukraine. But yes, there's definitely disagreement because there's not much known about what kind of troops, how many troops, under whose command, what would be the mission statement. So with so much open and no ceasefire in sight as yet in Ukraine, definitely the leaders weren't focusing on that. But they did also talk about or come to a conclusion on that. But they were also talking about spending more on defence, for example. And there they did agree, of course.
Katia, many thanks. Our Europe editor, Katia Adler, there live from the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Well, that meeting was taking place just before the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is due to sit down with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Riyadh for talks that will broach the subject of ending the war in Ukraine. Dan Reiter is a professor of political sciences at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He's the author of an influential book on peace negotiations called How Wars End. So what does he expect the US approach to these talks to be?
I think the strategy is to use the variety of levers it has to get a deal rapidly done. I think that the objective is to get a deal and a little bit less concerned with some priorities like making sure that Ukraine has long-term security.
So speed rather than attention to detail.
That would be my guess. I think that President Trump values the accomplishment of an end to the war and is a little bit less concerned if elements of the outcome are not quite satisfactory to all parties. Ukraine may be asked to accept limits on its military, you know, as part of the deal. There may be limits as to how many peacekeepers are placed in Ukrainian territory. And my sense is that the Trump administration is willing to do those sorts of things to get the deal done.
And would that explain why, for example, America appears, although there are conflicting statements about this, but appears at least to have suggested NATO membership has to be thought to be off the table, is unrealistic for Ukraine, and is saying no American boots on the ground in Ukraine as part of any kind of peacekeeping force? Is that why those things have been put out there already?
Yeah, I think there are different reasons why those items have been put out. I think that is the Trump administration's attempt to signal very strongly to Ukraine they need to come to the table. And for their perspective, that's a way to get a deal done faster.
What about the Europeans meeting today in Paris, concerned that they're being kept out of these negotiations? Are those concerns justified?
Justified is a tricky word. I'm sure they would like to be included. I think it would be in the best interest of everyone concerned if they were included. My guess is that, you know, Trump doesn't think too highly of the Europeans these days and would rather deal with Putin directly.
I suppose we then look at what the Ukrainians are going to be prepared to accept. You say they're probably going to have to accept a lot less than they'd like. But are there going to be red lines that the Ukrainians simply won't accept, or will they just have something imposed on them?
It's very hard to know what their red lines are because, you know, what is said in public isn't necessarily descriptive. You know, I think they would be very unwilling to give up more territory beyond what Russia already controls. I also think they would not be willing to give up significant restrictions on the size of their military after the peace deal is signed, because they recognize they will need to depend on themselves to protect themselves against future Russian aggression.
That was Dan Reiter. He's professor of political sciences at Emory University and author of How Wars End. Well, let's turn now to the approach of the Russian delegation at those talks in Riyadh. Dmitry Trenin is a Russian foreign policy expert, a former military intelligence officer. He's based in Moscow. He's also a member of the Russian International Affairs Council, a diplomatic think tank that's close to Russia's foreign ministry. And I asked him for the perspective of the negotiators from Moscow heading into tomorrow's discussions.
Well, I think that they're approaching it very seriously, but primarily they would want to know how far the United States is willing to go, how serious the United States is with regard to developing a pragmatic relationship with Russia, whether they understand that for Russia, ending the war means so much more than a ceasefire. Russians have been saying countless times that they want the roots of the conflict to be exterminated.
Well, spell out, if you will, Dmitry, what the roots are as far as Russia sees it, because sometimes these things get lost over time.
I think that route number one would be NATO's enlargement. And I would say it's not just a formal expansion of NATO, but the expansion of Ukraine's military ties to the West.
So does that even mean deals that are struck between individual NATO states and Ukraine?
Absolutely, absolutely. For Russians, who are mostly focused on the substance rather than the label, there's no difference between, let's say, UK-German forces in Ukraine and Ukraine and NATO.
So what about those deals that have already been struck? I mean, Britain's one of the countries that's already signed a bilateral security deal with Ukraine. Would that have to be reversed?
I think that from the Russian perspective, those deals will have to be cancelled.
Do you think that's realistic? I mean, is that something
the West can live with? I'm more concerned with what Russia can live with.
But what sort of a Ukraine would there be then in this arrangement?
Well, a neutral state, a state that is does not see Russia as an adversary, a state that is militarily neutral, Unfortunately, the actions of the European Union have led, I think, the Russians to believe that EU membership would not be a good thing for Ukraine. Russia was prepared to live with that right up until the conflict.
But not now?
No, I can't. I mean, the European Union has earned a very bad name in Russia.
You think that's possibly a red line then? Even if it's not a military alliance, but it's an economic alliance, that's still off the table, you think?
I don't like talking about red lines. I think it's the whole idea has been discredited in the course of the war. But I'm talking about things that Russia will not permit. I think I must mention that the very fact that the President of the United States is interested not in inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia, but in having a deal with Russia, this is a result not of the goodwill of a particular American president, but of the resilience demonstrated by Russia in the 3 years of the war and the successes of the Russian military.
And the realities are that Russia is clearly on the offensive at the moment. It is gaining ground, which makes people wonder, does President Putin really want a deal at this point? What's in it for him?
Well, President Putin wants peace on the terms that Russia would find acceptable. And I think we've discussed some of those terms. And unless and until those terms are within reach, I think Russia will continue to do what it has been doing for the past 3 years.
Where does Europe fit in to these discussions?
Unfortunately, it doesn't. I mean, it has, as I said, that the European Union has earned a bad name. I mean, some of those countries have surprised even me in their vehemence.
Can I ask you about one thing? We're getting ahead of ourselves talking about what a future peace agreement might look like. But I mean, one thing that's already been put out there by the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is the idea of sending British troops to Ukraine as part of a peacekeeping force. Is that something that would be acceptable in principle to the Kremlin, do you think?
It's a total non-starter.
Why is that?
Well, because no NATO country is, from the Russian standpoint, is acceptable as a peacekeeper in Ukraine. Just no NATO country. It's NATO boots on the ground. And Russia has been fighting, still continues to fight, to prevent precisely that situation.
Dmitry Trenin, Russian foreign policy expert, speaking to me from Moscow. Well, he says it's a non-starter for the Kremlin, but there have been calls for a vote in the Commons before any deployment of British peacekeeping troops to Ukraine. So let's find out what the public might think of this. Luke Trill is the UK director of the pollsters More in Common, and your organisation, good evening, Luke, your organisation has been looking at this, hasn't it?
We have, and good evening. We asked in January, actually, when this idea of Britain potentially sending troops to help be peacekeepers for any deal was being mooted. And what we found was that around half the public, 50%, said that they would support the use of British troops to act as peacekeepers for a peace deal in Ukraine. Only 22% said that they would oppose it, and 28% said neither support or oppose. That's the group that you imagine would want to look at the terms of us sending troops. But as it stands, the public about twice as likely to support sending troops than to oppose.
Much difference across party allegiances?
Well, what's interesting is that supporters of the big two parties, the Tories and Labour, are much more in favour than the average. Around 62% of Conservative voters say they would support it, 64% of Labour voters. But what's interesting is even amongst Reform voters, and we know that the Reform leadership has been more sceptical about Ukraine than the other parties, even amongst Reform voters, they are more likely than not to support sending troops. It's narrower, it's around 43 to 35%, but still more in favour. And I think it's really interesting because what we found throughout the war is that the UK hasn't seen that same degree of polarisation over Ukraine that we've seen, for instance, in the US, where there's a big Democrat-Republican divide, or even actually on the continent between supporters of parties on the right and the left.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's been interesting in focus groups talking to people that British people really do see standing up for Ukraine almost as a sort of existential matter of importance. It's interesting, fairly consistently since the war began, around 70 to 80% of the British public have said it's important to the UK that Ukraine succeeds, that it repels Russia, whatever that might ultimately look like. So I think it's that sense that it matters to us here, and also a sense that we have a duty to Ukrainians. Now, of course, there's also been the fact that there's been cross-party support for Ukraine. In fact, it was a centre-right Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who was so robust at the beginning, but actually Keir Starmer has picked up that support as well. And so we just haven't seen those splits. And actually, for lots of Britons, our role in Ukraine has become a matter of national pride in a period when we haven't had much to be proud about.
But there is the question of money, isn't there, and defence spending, which is being urged from across the Atlantic to increase. Is there a public appetite for the defence budget to be increased?
Well, there's certainly a public appetite for the government to spend more on defence. So when we asked last year, actually, around three quarters thought that spending more on defence was important for national security. But as ever with these public spending questions, there's less willingness for taxes to have to rise to pay for it. In fact, YouGov fellow pollsters had a poll out today which showed that around 55% would oppose paying higher taxes for more military spending. Only 30% would support it. So the public perhaps be a little bit cakeist when it comes to defence spending. They want the higher spending, but they don't necessarily want taxes to go up to pay for it.
Luke, many thanks. Luke Trill, UK Director of More in Common, which seems to sum up public attitudes towards Ukraine at least. Thanks for joining us. And coming up later on... In the latest of our Palestinian voices, we'll speak to a Palestinian-Israeli rapper on how art has kept him sane during the war in Gaza. Now, it's one of the government's central policy promises to build 1.5 million new homes in England over the next 5 years. But industry bodies are warning that there is a big obstacle to achieving this, a lack of workers. The Considerate Constructors Scheme, which supports and represents builders, is the latest organisation to say the government's major infrastructure projects are at risk of what it calls a black hole in recruitment. Well, Neil Jefferson is chief executive of the Home Builders Federation. Its members build around 80% of the new homes in England and Wales each year. Good evening.
Good evening, James.
So, as things stand right now with the number of homes that are being built, are there enough workers?
Yeah, I think at the moment I would say that labour issues are not top of the agenda for UK house builders. There are many other things that we could talk about, but that's mainly because we've actually seen a stagnation in terms of housing supply. In fact, a fall since the end of the previous Conservative government. Previous to that, we'd seen significant growth in housing supply in England and Wales, but it has fallen away. So I think there is some latent capacity. So I think to give an idea, at the moment, we think we're building around about 200,000 new homes a year compared with the 300,000 a year that would be needed to deliver that 1.5 million across the parliament in a running state.
Yeah, so that's an increase of 50%, if my maths are right. I mean, that presumably would take more skilled workers. Would they be easy to come by?
I think it's a major challenge. I think it's not, and it's not just in maybe the trades that we would talk about, such as bricklaying and carpentry, but also we need more planners, we need more managers. The skills are changing. Homes that are being built now will have heat pumps rather than gas boilers, and they'll have photovoltaic panels on the roof for creating electricity. All of this takes new skills. But I think that one of the most positive things I will take from the government's announcement with regards its ambition for building more homes is also an acknowledgement that we need to change the way that we attract and train people if we're going to get anywhere near those numbers. So we've already seen the announcement of Skills England. We've seen some joined up working between the various departments, including Department for Education, Business, Housing, the local communities, which is really good to see. And last week we heard announcements on training for apprenticeships, which was welcome news for employers because it means that apprenticeships can be more dynamic, shorter, and that will meet the needs of employers much better than, frankly, the archaic systems we have at the moment. So there's a lot to do. Things do need to change. Also, I think it's not just a call on government. The house building industry needs to take responsibility itself for training people, and we're seeing significant changes in that area as well. Most notably, a huge investment in a series of hubs, which skills hubs built next to existing sites. Sorry, James.
Is there a role though for migration? Is that going to be needed?
I think it's something that will be kept under scrutiny. I think that now we have the Migration Advisory Committee. We've got the shortage occupation list. It's kept under constant review. I would suspect that it may be a challenge for certain parts of the country if the growth does come through. London has to be a concern because we've seen a significant fall in housing supply in London. And if that was to pick up, we already rely on a significant percentage of overseas labour in London, around about 50%. So if London was to pick up, then I think questions will be asked. I think in other parts of the country, I would hope that through the changes that could be made and through that progressive growth that we see, that it won't be needed. But I think that it is something that will need to be kept under constant review.
Neil Jefferson, thanks very much. Chief Executive of the Home Builders Federation there. And in a statement, the government told us it is taking decisive action to fix the housing crisis. This includes tackling years of underinvestment in our skills system and a dire shortage of construction workers. It has announced changes to apprenticeships, which could see an extra 10,000 apprentices qualify each year, including in the construction sector. And they say the revised National Planning Policy Framework published in December 2024 was a key first step in reforming the planning system. Now let's get an update on Pope Francis, because he's being treated for a complex clinical situation and, according to the Vatican, will remain in hospital for as long as necessary. The 88-year-old was admitted to Rome's Gemelli Hospital on Friday to undergo treatment and tests for bronchitis. We can speak now to Claire Giangrave, who's in Italy and is Vatican correspondent for the Religion News Service. Good evening, Claire.
Good evening.
What is the latest that you are hearing?
Well, the latest development that we heard from the Vatican spokesperson is that the Pope's condition is currently stable and he does not have a fever. But he continues to do this therapy to treat the what now doctors believe is a polymicrobial infection of the respiratory tract, which means that various bacteria, fungi and viruses might be having an impact on the Pope's health.
And he's been suffering from bronchitis, what, for more than a week now, hasn't he? He couldn't deliver the weekly prayer to pilgrims.
Absolutely.
Has he been seen much?
For us who have been watching him closely for the past 10 days, but I would like to say even longer, he's been looking quite bloated because of the cortisol treatment that he's been doing in the past 10 days, but also he's been struggling to read the speeches and make the various liturgies, perform the various ceremonies that as pontiff he has to oversee, and he's had other people do them in his place. This is a very tiring time for popes, not just because we're out of the Christmas season, which is very labor-intensive, but also because...
Can you still hear us, Claire? Oh, I think we've lost the line to Claire. We're going to try. Is she still there? No, we've lost the line. Apologies for that. Oh, no, she is back. Claire, you with us?
Oh, yes, I apologize.
Sorry, we just lost the line briefly. You were talking about how busy this time of year is for the Pope.
Absolutely. This is the Jubilee year where pilgrims from all over the world are coming to Rome and they expect to see the Pope. And it's been very tiring for an 88-year-old pontiff, one of the oldest in the church's history.
We understand, though, he has been able to do some work to make phone calls, for example.
Yes, the Vatican spokesman today told us that not only does he continue his routine of calling the Catholic Holy Family parish in Gaza, but he has also been reading And, importantly, today the Pope appointed the first woman, Sister Raffaella Petrini, to head the Governatorate of the Vatican. It's essentially as if the Vatican had a female prime minister. This is a lot about a Pope who might be sick physically, but has a clear mind of what his legacy and his pontificate will be beyond him.
Claire, thank you very much for that update. Claire Giangrave, a Vatican correspondent for the Religion News Service. Israel's defense minister has announced the formation today of a special agency for the voluntary departure of Gazans. It is the latest sign that Israel is embracing Donald Trump's proposal for relocating the population of the Gaza Strip so that the United States can take over the territory and rebuild it. Arab leaders are rather more skeptical about that idea. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, ahead of his meetings with Sergei Lavrov, has been holding meetings today in Saudi Arabia with senior figures in the kingdom, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, to discuss alternative Arab plans for the territory. Meanwhile, here on The World Tonight, we have been speaking to Palestinians from different walks of life about how they see their future. Tonight, we are going to hear from Tamer Nafa. He's a member of the Palestinian hip-hop collective Dam. He and his fellow band members are among the nearly 2 million Palestinians who live in Israel and have Israeli passports. They do have relatives in Gaza, though. So what impact has the war there had on his art?
Every artist can say music is my therapy. It sounds a bit like a cliche. If there wasn't for art during this insane period of time, we are witnessing horrors that we are supposed to read in history as we live. So music was my therapy and my therapist was my therapy as well. I had to use both.
But what did you find yourself writing about? Did you find yourself writing about things that were far removed from war and politics?
It's that juggling part. Writing is my profession, so I'm signed to contracts where I have deadlines to deliver. So it's not just about of being in the mood to write or not. You need to sit your ass down and just work like any other person, even if you don't like the job, okay? It's hard to disconnect. It's hard to ignore the elephant in the room. It's hard to ignore more than 50,000 people massacred in Gaza. So I would say that, yes, there was a lot of articles that I wrote, but to remember that I'm a human being and I'm an artist, I also did all kind of songs that were about love, but I didn't release them, though, because it's not the time.
Has it been difficult? Have you felt that even if you do want to write about the situation in Gaza or write anything political, is it more difficult in today's Israel?
First of all, yes, and it's not a monster under the bed. It's a fact. You have more than 30 Palestinians living in Israel being arrested for just a naive, innocent post. But I've noticed that the press is still free in a way. So I believe in that Bruce Lee saying, be water, my friend. So what I felt is, since I have a lot to say, I just, instead of posting things on media, I just wrote it and used the press as articles, as I said. This is what made me go more into the press side.
Do you see any improvements coming? Do you think if this ceasefire lasts, things could improve?
I don't know. I know that my writing is improving. That's what I control, brother.
But is it improving because of the situation? Is it having a positive impact?
Look, we cannot just pass on and wish for a better life. Something that needs to be done. You cannot have a bully doing whatever they want, and not maybe, you know, we can, I said the word massacre at the beginning, maybe some people will raise their bra. You know what, I don't want to use that word. What I'm saying is, it needs to be investigated. I think a better future is if we look bravely in the eyes of the present, and we just go and we investigate everything, the 7th of October, whatever is happening in Gaza. And if everyone is innocent, everyone's innocent. If everyone is it needs to be charged, they need to be charged. How would I feel happy if I know that someone had the ability, no matter which side now, had the ability to go kill, drop bombs, and then nobody confronts him and that's it?
Is there anything that art can do positively, though, in this situation, do you think?
I think that what I can do is document the emotions that we are having right now. That's my job. In one of the songs, in one of the lines, I say that art, music, it's not a pilot. It's not Captain Sully. It's not going to stop the crash. But it's like a black box. It's there to document what is happening. And this is art, again, to change the world. For me, to change the world, you need a country, you need an army, you need economy, you need bondings with other countries. This is what changed the world. This is what decides if Gaza, for example, if Gazan people are going to stay in their houses or not. It's part of the decisions. So I can't say my song or any other song will beat these forces. I'm not disrespecting any artist. I'm fully aware of my contribution to the world, and it's art, and I'm going to focus on it. What it does, you know, sometimes it's like a lottery. I don't know. But for me, does it change? Does it? It won't change. It won't change the fact that this is my talent, this is my skill, and I'm going to keep improving in that.
The reflections are of Tamer Nafa, who's a hip-hop artist and a Palestinian citizen of Israel. A quick look now at tomorrow's front pages of the newspapers. And unsurprisingly, Ukraine dominates. The Daily Telegraph front page says Germany rejects the Prime Minister's Ukraine peace plan. The Times leads with Ukraine needs US safety pledges, PM to tell Trump. That's at the meeting that Keir Starmer will attend with President Trump in America next week. And the I newspaper says Britain braced for more cuts to boost defence spending over Ukraine crisis, something we touched on earlier there with Luke Trill. Now we're going to turn our mind to the climate crisis and ask this question: could wolves be part of the solution to it? A research by a team of scientists from the University of Leeds suggests that reintroducing wolves to the Scottish Highlands, re-wolfing perhaps, would reduce the red deer population there and in turn lead to an expansion of woodland, which is a natural carbon store. Professor Dominic Spracklin is the lead author of the report and he spoke to the BBC.
We're facing major crises in biodiversity and climate change. I think we need to start to think more broadly and think about trying to restore healthy ecosystems, restore some of the lost species back into those ecosystems could help us address some of those really large challenges. In Europe, wolves have started to recolonize large parts of their former range. They're now in Germany. They're now in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands is, you know, really densely populated with humans. And wolves are living there quite close to humans within, you know, densely populated areas, showing that that coexistence is possible. There are challenges across Europe with livestock farmers. But in some areas, farmers are learning to how to live with wolves back in the landscape. And there's some inspiring stories about farmers finding old methods, I guess, of how they did that in the past and using them again.
Professor Dominic Spracklin. Well, let's hear from the farming community. Martin Kennedy is former president of the National Farmers Union Scotland. He was part of a team that visited Norway to examine the impact of reintroducing wolves there. And he's on the line. Good evening, Martin.
Good evening, James.
So what's your view? You went and saw at first hand what the experience was in Norway. What did it lead you to think about reintroducing wolves in Scotland?
Extremely concerned, James. I mean, there was a team of us went out in 2017 specifically to speak to Norwegian farmers and the impact they had with predation. It was right across the board. It was actually lynx we were looking at, but it was lynx, it was wolverine, it was wolves, it was bears. And the reintroduction of these species decimated a lot of the farming communities, particularly on the high altitude areas, like, you know, similar to some areas we have in Scotland, the less favoured areas where we have a lot of livestock. And over the period of 10 years, there was 1,000 farmers that had actually given up. And so we've got to remember that it's not all, you know, we'll have to be careful about woodland and creating more woodland. Climate change is a big issue right across the globe. We need to be able to control the fuel load that we actually have in our ground now. So grazing livestock, producing nutrient-dense protein and actually creating an environment that's conducive to great biodiversity is something we're really proud of in Scotland. So be very, very careful we don't compromise our ability to produce that protein as well.
Understood. But the professor there was suggesting that farmers in other parts of Europe have been able to coexist with predators. Well, is that something that could happen in Scotland?
Yeah, well, really interesting, James, because I've been in with the part of the NFU Scotland job as president for the past 4 years. I've been in COPA and Brussels meetings, you know, every couple of months over the past 4 years. And when you're speaking to farmers out there, I can assure you that's not where they are. They're having massive problems just now with large carnivores, and it's having a big impact on not only people's livelihoods, but and the ability to keep landscapes in a state that's not going to be conducive to wildfires. We've just seen in 2023 the biggest wildfire that the UK has seen on Cannock Estate in the Southerns, 30 square miles where there's been no burning, no livestock grazing, and that's the impact of that was fuel load. This just passed in October there was a world meeting of specialists across the world from the fire service that was looking at specifically on fuel load and for wildfires across Scotland. We need to keep
What about the problem that the professor there is suggesting that the wolves can solve, which is that of the red deer eating the tree saplings?
Yeah, I think that's incredible, really. So, you know, we should be able to control the deer without having wolves to control the deer. The issue we have with deer at the minute, venison is a very high quality lean protein meat, and is very dense, nutrient dense protein, which we should be using. We do not value that anymore. And the problem is, if we were to focus more on our diets, we would value venison. And the beauty of having good venison that we can actually control, and it's wild animals we're actually trying to control the deer population, is which we do have to do. But we need to use that venison and use that as part of our diet as well. And being realistic, you know, when you go back 40, 50 years ago, when there was, yes, and there were a bit of a nuisance, some would say, with a lot of poachers on the land, and they controlled numbers to a degree, but that's not happening now. And people are so used to having food that is very cheap, very affordable, affordable's fine, but cheap's not.
Right, so you're not saying more poachers, you're saying eat more venison.
No, I'm not saying more poached, absolutely not. I'm just saying what did happen up to then. But we did manage the deer population. But we need to do this and we have to think about this. You know, when wolves were here 400 years ago, there was only 1 million people in Scotland, if that, in total. We've got a world population now that is growing at a huge rate of knots. We're over 8 billion now, and we need to have the ability to produce food, which we can do in Scotland very, very well. And we have a thing in Scotland called rain, which a lot of parts of the world do not have. We think it's a nuisance sometimes. Very often as farmers, we think we really curse the rain, but actually it's one of the biggest assets we have, and our ability to use that and manage our landscapes with cattle, with sheep, without Martin, the worry of predation is really concerning. So we can do it well.
In praise of rain and venison. Martin Kennedy, former president of the National Farmers Union Scotland, thanks very much. Our closing headline tonight. Sir Keir Starmer has said any Ukraine peace deal would require a US backstop to deter Russia from attacking its neighbour again. Speaking after a hastily convened meeting with other European leaders in Paris, the Prime Minister repeated that he would consider deploying UK troops to Ukraine in the event of a lasting peace agreement. The US and Russia will discuss ending the Ukraine conflict when they hold high-level talks in Saudi Arabia tomorrow. Sir Keir Starmer will meet Donald Trump next week in Washington. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'm back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Studio direction was by Holly Palmer. The editor was Matthew Symington.